We're going to turn our attention now to the Word of God, reading together from the book of Psalms, Psalm number 39, and you'll find that in the Good News Bible around about page 559. You'll find a copy of the Bible underneath the seat that you're sitting on or the seat in front of you, and I think you will find it helpful if you have a copy of the Bible open at that page so that together we can read and understand this song from the Old Testament, this item of worship or meditation or poetry, which helps us to understand how folks in those days, for whom things didn't always go easy, perhaps managed to cope with what was happening to them and to understand the challenges of their faith in God. So Psalm 39, page 559, and we're going to begin by reading the psalm and then thinking a little bit about the first few verses, and then we'll look at the rest of the psalm, where it really takes a turn that's difficult for us to understand, or at least that surprises us when it comes from the Bible. It's easy to understand, but it's surprising to find it in the Bible. And then we'll take time at the end of our service just to try and relate what the Word of God says to us here to our own experience of life. So Psalm 39, the Good News Bible, has the title, The Confession of a Sufferer. I said, I will be careful what I do, and will not let my tongue make me sin. I will not say anything while evil people are near. I kept quiet, not saying a word, not even about anything good. But my suffering only grew worse, and I was overcome with anxiety. And the more I thought, the more troubled I became. And I could not keep from asking, Lord, how long will I live? When will I die? And tell me how soon my life will end. How short you have made my life. In your sight, my lifetime seems nothing. Indeed, every living being is no more than a puff of wind, no more than a shadow. And all they do is for nothing. They gather wealth, but don't know who will get it. What then can I hope for, Lord? I put my hope in you. Save me from all my sins and don't let fools laugh at me. I will keep quiet. I will not say a word, for you are the one who has made me suffer like this. Don't punish me anymore. I am about to die from your blows. You punish our sins by your rebukes, and like a moth, you destroy what we love. Indeed, we are no more than a puff of wind. Hear my prayer, Lord, and listen to my cry, and come to my aid when I weep. Like all my ancestors, I am only your guest for a little while. Leave me alone, so that I may have some happiness before I go away and am no more. And you might well turn the page looking for the rest of the psalm, because that's not where we expect it to end, but it is where it does end. And that's part of the problem we're going to try and wrestle with this morning. I guess many is the time that all of us speak out of turn. Sometimes in anger, without restraint, sometimes in ignorance, without really understanding what we're talking about, sometimes insensitively, with the result that we hurt somebody else's feelings, or sometimes in haste, perhaps volunteering too quickly for things we didn't want to do. I said to myself in haste a week ago, we'll look at Psalm 39 this Sunday, and many's the time during the last few days when I wished we'd done Psalm 23 instead, or something else that's easy. The New Testament does teach us always to speak carefully. So the book of James in chapter 3 warns that the tongue is like a spark that could set a whole forest on fire, or like a wild animal that no one can tame. Paul says plainly in Ephesians chapter 4, 29, something that probably the people he was writing to needed to hear, and maybe we do as well: do not use harmful words, but only helpful words, the kind that build up and provide what is needed. And Jesus gets to the root of the problem in Matthew chapter 12, verse 34, when he says, the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. And that's the problem. We speak out of turn because our heart is full of things that shouldn't be there. So the only way to make sure that we really don't ever say anything wrong is to get our hearts right with God. But until that happens, it means that all of us are liable to what they call foot and mouth disease. You know what that is? It's when you open your foot and put your mouth in it. And all of us are in danger of getting that kind of thing wrong. So Psalm 39 follows the trend of that New Testament teaching when it says in verse 1, I said to myself, I will be careful what I do and will not let my tongue make me sin. But then it goes on to say something slightly different when it says in the second half of verse 1, I will not say anything while evil men are near. And that begs the question, why is it in particular that the presence of evil men should make this singer of a biblical psalm, this leader of God's praise, want to keep quiet? Surely the Bible should encourage us when evil men are here, or evil women as well, when evil people are around us, the Bible should encourage us to speak out for God, to bear Christian witness, to share our faith. But here the man says, whatever else is on my mind or on my lips, I'm not going to speak out when there's a possibility that anyone who is not fully committed to the Lord my God might overhear what I might say. Why is he going to zip his mouth then? And as we read on, we recognize that this is a psalm sung by a man who is under pressure. He talks about being in trouble. He talks about feeling anxious. He talks about enduring suffering. He talks about blows which are very nearly fatal, or very soon will be. So inside his head, he is raging against God. He's angry. He's hurting. He doesn't understand. He's full of doubts and complaints. And yet in spite of that fact, something very like loyalty to God still prevents him from speaking his mind. I'm going to take special care not to say what I think, because some evil people round about me might hear it and perhaps agree with me. What do you say when people ask you how you are? How are things going for you? If things are not going well, what do you say? Probably we have three choices. One of them is simply to tell a lie. How are things? They're fine. Or don't ask. Things are okay. We either tell people what we think they want to hear, because they haven't got time for a full heart-to-heart, or else we tell them what we feel that Christians ought to say. We think that Christian faith belongs to those who have a smile stitched onto their mouths, and happiness should be their outward clothing all the time. So we pretend that everything is fine, and if there is an obvious problem, then we say it's okay because my faith and my prayers are getting me through this difficult situation. We can lie about it. Or secondly, we can do what a lot of Christian writers sometimes do, and many of us as well, which is simply shrink God. That's an easy way of dealing with problems. We can profess faith in a God who isn't responsible for the bad things that happen to us. A God who is sympathetic. A God who is very comforting. A God who provides us with friends who will get us through or who will at least come alongside, but a God who bears no responsibility. He's a little corner God. Overwhelmed by wars and financial crisis and sickness and ill health and all the other things that he might help us cope with, but isn't responsible for himself. Or we can tell the truth, which is to admit that the God whom we believe to be all-powerful, immortal, invisible, God only wise, is giving us a really hard time. So those are the options, but the first one can't be right, because it's never right to tell a lie, however good the intention is. The second one can't be right, because it can't be right to talk God's down, even if we think that by doing it we're protecting his reputation. God doesn't want a reputation for being stuck in a corner and not much use. But if you tell the truth in front of evil men, there is this danger, either that they will mock your faith and strengthen the foundations of their own unbelief. How can you believe in a God who lets such bad things happen to you? What is the point of having faith if it doesn't make you feel happy or secure? Or the added danger that what they say is so convincing and so reasonable that you end up agreeing with them. And so the psalmist tries option number four, which is to zip it. I kept quiet in verse 2, not saying a word, not even about anything good. And you do have to admire something about that resolution, that determination, almost to stand between God and other human beings and protect God from the things that are coming his way. Either to protect the evil men from the words that might have come out, or to protect himself from the accusations against God which they might bring. There's something, albeit misplaced, there's something noble and brave about what he's trying to do by the middle of verse 2. But it doesn't work, because silence turns out to be an ill-fated strategy. The unasked questions don't go away. The secret doubts are not resolved. And so in verse 2, my suffering only got worse, and I was overcome with anxiety, until finally, inevitably, the dam burst and the vow of silence broke. Because the more I thought about it in verse 3, the more troubled I became, and I could not keep myself from asking. My vow of silence was impossible to keep. And it's at this point, either by good fortune or by good design, either by the psalmist's intention or by God's intervention, it's at this point that by good fortune, the person in whose presence he breaks his silence is not the evil men, but the Lord. In verse 4, and the Lord did not laugh at his foolish questions or strike him down in anger for having the temerity to ask them. We know that because we're able to read the rest of the song. And if God had felt that these were questions that shouldn't have been asked in his presence, then they wouldn't be here, because the psalmist would never have got to verse 13. And that teaches us one vital lesson, which is that when God is confusing us or making us suffer in pain and frustration, the one person to whom we can safely talk about it is the God whom we blame. The God who is big enough to take responsibility for everything that happens to us. We don't need to tell a lie to God about God, or make excuses for God to God, or be afraid to speak the truth to him. If we speak out, it might well be that evil folks will exploit us. If we keep quiet, it will certainly be the case that the pressure will crush us. But if we open ourselves up to God in prayer, we discover that nothing is too dangerous to discuss with him. Nothing is too simple for him to spend time on. Nothing is so direct that he will get embarrassed about answering it. And so neither need we. Nothing is disallowed or ruled out of order. You can't ask that question inside this church. And nothing is said in vain. So that's the easy bit of the psalm done. Or maybe it's not. Maybe that's actually the difficult bit, that all you need to do is pray about it. What happens when the prayers are things we don't feel like praying for? Or what happens when we just can't find it within us to be noble and brave and faithful and bold in our approach to God? The psalmist takes it to the Lord in prayer in verse 4, and yet the question that he asks of the Lord is a surprising one. He says, "Lord, how long shall I live? And when shall I die? And tell me how soon my life will end." And the reason for that is simply because his feeling is that the sooner his life comes to an end, the better. He's had it with this experience of living. He's tried it. It's been bitter. He's had no help from his spiritual life. And he's just saying to God, "Look, how much longer do I have to put up with this? Because if it's all the same to you, I'd rather we just called it quits." That's what's on his mind. And as we go through the next few verses, we see a chain of good reasons that leads him towards that conclusion. The first and link in that chain is verse 5, where he reflects on his experience that life is insignificant. Every living person is no more than a puff of wind. Hold your hand up in front of your face and blow on it. What happens? Your hand feels a breath of wind, doesn't it? But what does it feel now? Nothing. The wind has been and gone. And he's saying, "Look, God, I've looked at my own life. I've looked at other people's lives. I've seen them doing and making an impression, doing things, making a difference to the world around them. But the difference they make is like the wind growing across a field of grass. The grass bends over in front of the wind, but then the wind stops. The grass goes back to where it was. There's no point in trying to make a difference," he says, "because none of it will last. At the end of my life, it will be as if I had never lived." And then comes the second link in his chain, because the answer to that might well be, well, we all of us leave something behind. We may save up some money, which is left to someone else in our will, or we might make a lasting impression on the people that we have been close to. But he reflects in verse 6 that life is out of our control. Someone gathers wealth, but does not know who will get it or who will inherit it. So the difference we do end up making might be exploited for evil by other people or simply go to waste. Might simply be passed on to people whom we do not love. Perhaps he's speaking out of an experience of grief. Perhaps he's a parent who has lost a child and his hope for the future has disappeared with them. Or maybe he's a member of a family whose relatives have turned against him in that kind of dispute, which makes him feel that he doesn't really want to leave his inheritance to anybody, because the folks who are most likely to get it don't deserve it. And he didn't have the cat and dog home in Israel to leave your legacy to instead. Or maybe he just lives in a vulnerable place where you might spend all your life building a house, establishing a home, planting your crops, and just when you think that you've provided for your family, an invading army comes in, or a swarm of locusts, or a drought, or a financial crisis, a credit crunch. And you cannot be sure that anyone will get the benefit of what you've done. And then he comes to the third link of his chain in verses 7 to 10, which is that he has only himself to blame. He might have gone to God and said, look, this is really unfair asking me to live this kind of life. But instead, he finds that when he does go to God, all he can say in verse 8 is, save me from all my sins. And don't punish me anymore. But the appeal for an end to his punishment is based not on the fact that he doesn't deserve it, but simply on the fact that he cannot stand it. He cannot appeal to justice because justice condemns him. Now, sometimes we are foolish enough to think when things are going wrong that if we could only get a hold of God and argue our case out with him, we could either be so successful, so convincing in the way that we put things, or else so sincere in our pledge that we'll do better next time around that we could change his mind. And the truth is that if you don't take it to the Lord in prayer, but instead take your case to evil men or even to sympathetic friends, you might well be able to persuade them of that truth and make that case stick. But one of the reasons why the Lord is such a good person to talk to is because he doesn't just agree with us or tell us what we want to hear. We go to the Lord and say, what have I done to deserve this? And he might say, would you like a list? Or he might say, what have you done to deserve anything better? And we'd find that our conversation, however well rehearsed, would turn out to be very short. And so the psalmist finds himself in this dilemma, my hope is in the Lord, but he knows that I am a sinner. His punishment will silence me because it is just. And the final link in his chain in verse 11 is this law of diminishing returns. Not just that things are bad or difficult now, but they can only ever get worse. Because he describes God as being like a moth in verse 11. Like a moth you destroy what someone loves. In other words, there are things that I've been looking forward to. Life is not all bad. Yes, it's been a struggle. But there are things I've been preparing for the future. Maybe I've been saving up for my retirement. Or maybe I've been looking forward to getting married. Or to that time when my children are old enough to support me and bear some of the burden for me. Or I've worked for years as an apprentice, but soon I'm going to get promotion. Or all these things I've been looking forward to. Life's hard, but it will be worth it in the long run. And then he finds that when he gets to the long run and takes out the things that he's been looking for, the clothes he's wanted to wear on that special occasion for which everything has been preparation, he finds that instead of those special clothes, all that he's got left is a bundle of moth-eaten rags. Do you know when I was 6 years old, there was one thing I wanted more than all the rest in all the world. Do you know what it was? I wanted to be 10. Because 10-year-old boys could climb the tree that was out the back of our garden. I would be big enough and strong enough to do what I wanted to. And then when you're 18, you look forward to being 21. When you've got no money, you look forward to getting a job and then to getting promotion. You look forward to buying a house and then to getting a bigger one. And all your life, you look forward to finding things out, to finding the answers to the questions, so that the angst that you've felt and the problems that have troubled you will gradually be resolved. You look forward to getting bigger and stronger so that the things that were out of reach at 6 or 10 or 18 or 21, you get better at them. You look forward to acquiring the wisdom and the wealth and the experience that will equip you to deal with life in a more effective way, thinking that the combination of experience and power will guarantee your freedom. And the difficulty is that it never quite comes. And then we have two options. One is the foolish one. One is the foolish one that says the reason my clothes have been eaten by the moths is because I didn't have enough mothballs. I've made mistakes. I've got it wrong. And if only I'd got it right, it would have been different. And that's okay because my children or the next generation are coming after me and I can teach them to get it right, and that will give me a reason for living because they will have the full set of clothes that I never had a chance to wear. And all we do is perpetuate the cycle, and the moths have a feast. Or the wise ones come to realize that what we have been trying to do could never work. Not because we have failed, but because what we have placed our hope in is entirely unable to deliver. Even at infinite wealth cannot buy us happiness. Even a healthy lifestyle is not immune to aging. Even all the wisdom in the world is not going to protect us from confusion. Or all the meditation techniques provide us with peace of mind. Even the blessing of a happy marriage is only until death do us part. And in the end, it is only the moths who don't go hungry. And that is the reality that this psalmist is wrestling with. And the tragedy is that many people who are less wise than he is would try to help him by persuading him that he is wrong. Buck yourself up, finding something useful to do with your time. Occupy yourself and you'll get over it. And the truth is that he is the one who has come to the right conclusion. And all the rest are wrong. And so he comes to his closing prayer in verses 12 and 13, which is a prayer of little hope. Not the false high hopes of the person who abandons God and puts their trust in fate. Or the false high hopes of the person who does not know themselves and think that they deserve better. Or the false high hopes of the person who does not know God and thinks that he is bound to take pity on us eventually and sort us out. But the little hope of the one who sees and understands and prays on the basis of experience in verse 13, leave me alone that I may have some happiness before I go away and am no more. You see what his prayer is? You see what the heights of his expectations are after a lifetime of bitter experience? He's saying, Lord, could I just have a few hours in a deck chair in the sun before I die? Because I see no other prospect and no other way out of this situation. And then you turn the page looking for the rest of the prayer, looking for the second half of the psalm, looking for the intervention of God, for the Holy Spirit to come, for something that will change and transform, that will take this man out of the pit that he is in and lift him up to the heights of God's presence and give him something truly to sing about, that will take the sad song from a minor key and make it better. And we turn the page and there's nothing more there. And neither the original singer nor the editor of the songbook has tried to add a final verse in with a clap and a cheer and a chorus. But they've left it like this because this is where it ends. What are we to say about Psalm 39 as we come to read it this morning? I want to suggest a number of things. I want to suggest, first of all, that this is a realistic prayer. That what it dares to do is look the facts of life fully in the face and does not duck the issue. Although we do not like the conclusion to which it comes, we ought to recognize the evidence that it's based on. And not do what we sometimes might be tempted to do, to say that all this suffering cannot be real. And if only I had the strength of mind or the strength of faith, I could make it disappear. Well, the Bible says, no, the suffering is real. And there are things to be anxious about and troubles to face and blows with which you are going to be struck. And actually, if that is the real world you live in, it's better to have a Bible that includes Psalms like this, that one which pretends that these things don't happen and would be a closed book to us for much of the time. So this psalm is realistic, and there are times when we need to sing it. And the second thing is to say that while we do want to change the ending and not just leave it there and turn it from little hope into at least a little faith, there are times when this is far as we can go, when the happy ever after ending of faith is so far out of sight that there's no point in looking for it. And rather than seeking to change the mind of the person who wants to sing this song, the best thing for us to do is to get down into that minor key and sing it along with them. Because there are times when this is as far as we can go. And then to realize along with that, that in spite of all the negativity, this is still a song of praise. For the God from whom so little is expected at the end of the psalm is still a song from whom the person is singing it cannot turn away, or a God from whom he cannot turn away, simply because there is nowhere else to turn. He's looked everywhere for comfort, for fulfillment, and there isn't anything. So even the fruits of bitter experience, fairly understood, actually don't give the evil men anything to crow about, because the non-God in whom they believe can't provide anything better or come up with any more satisfying expectation. They too are dressed in moth-eaten rags at the end of the day. So this is still a psalm of praise. But then also to say, as we eventually have to, that there is more to life than this, that there is at the core of this psalm, however real it feels all the way through the singing of it, there is something that has not quite fully taken credit of the nature and character of God. There's a novel I once read by a guy called Chaim Potok, and I couldn't find it, so I can't quote it exactly, but it's about a welfare worker in the United States during the Great Depression, I think. And this guy is working hard and slaving away and giving up the best years of his life in writing reports and going through procedures and trying to labor away at his task of making the world a better place for other people. And some of his friends come to him and tell him that he is killing himself. He's wasting his time. He's trying too hard to do something which is simply impossible. And he had better come to the kind of senses that this psalmist has at the end and reduce his expectations and just live with it. And he replies by saying something like this. He says, "I recognize that my life is nothing, that it will pass in the blink of an eye." But then he goes on to say, "The eye that blinks is something special. I am nothing, and I will pass in the blink of an eye, but the eye that blinks, he is something. The God who sees misses nothing." And here it says twice in verses 5 and 11 that a man is no more than a puff of wind. And in a similar vein, one of the other psalms says, Psalm 103, "As for us, our days are like grass. We flourish like a flower of the field, but the wind blows over it and it is gone, and its place remembers it no more." But that psalm goes on to say that from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear him. The grass may have bent over and sprung back up into its place so that those who see the grass do not see any difference. But God remembers that it was once bent over, and it matters to him. So it's not on families and friends or neighborhoods and places of work that we might leave a lasting impression. And it's certainly not on our gravestones or epitaphs or commemorative plaques that we should seek to be remembered. It's on the eternal memory of God that something is inscribed which shall never be rubbed out, that a difference is made which will last. And so what the moths destroy does not matter, and nor does the treasure which the rust will eat away. That's what Jesus explains in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, verse 20, when he says, "Instead, store up riches for yourself in heaven, where moths and rust cannot destroy, and robbers can't break in and steal. For your heart will always be where your riches are." And maybe it is that Jesus, when he said this, was thinking of this psalm and the moth that his father had been accused of being, and trying to reach down and lift up the person who's found himself in this terrible plight. Your heart will always be where your riches are, and heaven's richest treasure is Jesus himself. And that's actually what I think this psalm points out by its unsatisfactory ending, where we're left at verse 13 is with a gap that something simply has to fill. Our minds will not accept a prayer of little hope as the final word, and so something else has to be said. The writer George MacDonald says that everything difficult indicates something more than our theory of life yet embraces. Everything difficult indicates something more than our theory of life yet embraces. In other words, if things don't make sense to us, it doesn't mean that things don't make sense. It just means that we don't yet know enough to fully understand them. And what this psalmist's empty ending reveals is the space that Jesus needs to fill. That Jesus, for whom this psalm could in fact have been written, if you think about it, he was a man who lived a short, troubled, and anxious life, surrounded by evil men who took his words and twisted them and used them in accusations against him, and whose lifetime seemed to make little difference to the people around him. A Jesus who was himself succeeded by those who went on to abandon and betray him. Not just in the few days surrounding his death, but in the generations ever since, folks who have unworthily abused and trashed his legacy. Jesus, who knew that he was paying the price and being punished for sins, and justice could not get him off the hook. And Jesus, who had nothing to wear in the end, apart from a crown which was of thorns. So it could be said that in effect in verse 13, these are the words he prayed in Gethsemane. "Lord, leave me alone so that I may have some happiness." But then he said, "Not my will, but yours be done." And for that reason, says Paul in Philippians chapter 2, verse 9, God raised him to the highest place above and gave him the name that is greater than any other. And then Jesus says in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 13, "Here I am with the children that God has given me." So while the little hope of the psalm was at least in part that we cannot know who will get what is left of the wealth we gather after the moths have had their fill, here is Jesus who knows that the wealth which he inherits and which nothing can destroy is shared with those who will come after him. Now we've cheated, in a sense. We've read the psalm and then added the ending that the author had too much integrity to put there. And so we need to remember that sometimes this is all we have, and not look for false faith or express unfelt happiness. We need to recognize that there are times when life can be like this, and yet still all we have to cling to is God, not because we fully understand him and not because he makes us feel better, but simply because there's no one else. But we also need to see that God will not leave it there, and that here is a feeling which demands a Christ, because this is not right. And God is righteous and just and loving, and knows us and gives us what we need.